praise to you. Amen. Okay, very good. We are in Vayishlach, which means, and he sent. It's Genesis chapter 32 through 36. So, I'll read the brief summary that Sachs provides. Vayishlach tells the story of the meeting after an estrangement that lasted 22 years between Jacob and Esau. Hearing that his brother is coming to meet him with a force of 400 men, Jacob is greatly afraid and distressed. He divides his camp, and of course his camp is made up of his wives, his children, and all of the people who are connected to his household. He divides his camp into two parts. He sends gifts to Esau and prays. That night he wrestles with a mysterious stranger in an episode that ends with his being given a new name, Israel, meaning one who struggles with God and men and prevails. The next day the two brothers meet, not in violence, but in peace. They embrace and then they go their separate ways. The parsha ends with the death of Isaac. By the way, I see that it's parasha here, but parasha and parsha are two different ways of pronouncing the same word. Okay? The parsha ends with the death of Isaac and a genealogy of the descendants of Esau. The first of the following studies, and there are four essays in this commentary on each of the Torah portions. The first of the following studies examines Jacob's state of mind before the meeting, exploring the difference between physical fear and moral distress. The second analyzes the wrestling match with the stranger and what it tells us about Jacob's inner struggle of identity and self-image. The third relates Jacob's struggle to our own responses to crisis, which is obviously the one we are reading. And the fourth asks what it means to be a descendant of a man whose name means one who struggles with God and men, arguing that Judaism is the countervoice in the conversation of humankind. Okay? So we're going to look at the third of these four essays, Surviving Crisis. Sometimes it just feels more appropriate to read the commentary and then talk about some of the details. And sometimes, like in today's case, it works out better to break at certain points in the essay and to discuss a couple of things. Okay, so he begins by saying the Torah is not just a book to read. It is a book to live by. In that spirit, I want to reflect in this essay on how the story of Jacob's wrestling match with the angel can help us survive crisis when we, like our ancestor, feel ourselves alone, afraid, and in distress. And I would guess that there have been occasions in your life when you have felt one or all three of these things, right? You feel alone, you're afraid, and in distress. It can happen in many ways. We can lose our job, our savings, our self-respect. We can suffer bereavement and feel ourselves surrounded by a cloud of grief. We can find ourselves in the midst of controversy, subject to the sometimes brutal criticism of others. We can feel ourselves to be a failure. There are terrifying moments when life seems drained of meaning, when we can no longer concentrate or connect with others, when we find it hard to sleep at night or stay awake during the day. When mere existence seems a burden we lack the strength to carry. At such times, it can sometimes help to retrace the steps of our ancestors when they faced similar situations. One of the most beautiful aspects of Genesis, often lost when we read the stories through the lens of Midrash, is that its heroes and heroines are recognizably human. And I have made this observation many times. I think it is perhaps one of the most important observations that can be made about the biblical text, is how honest it is. How honest the Bible is with the people whose lives we experience page after page after page, right? I mean, they are real people. They deal with real issues. They struggle with real things. They make mistakes. They sin. They experience, of course, great triumphs in their lives as well. But the fact of the matter is, they're just regular people, right? We tend to pedestalize them. We tend to ignore the blemishes and only look at the triumphs. But often ignore the difficulty. But one of the nice things about the Bible has to do with the fact that it is so honest about the way people are, right? And in the Bible, you see the bad as well as the good, right? So that, frankly, should be a source of encouragement to us. They, too, have fears and doubts, none more so than Jacob, the man whose name Israel, we, the people of Israel, obviously, bear. Often it is argued that we should not read the text at its surface meaning, precisely because that would make them seem mere mortals like us. And there is much more to be said for this point of view. But there is a contrary case. The Torah portrays the patriarchs and matriarchs in all of their human complexity, so that we can identify with them and take strength from their stories rather than seeing them as impossibly remote from all we know and are. What follows is what I have learned, what Rabbi Sacks has learned from Jacob's nighttime struggle. Okay? Now, I wanted to take a moment and read this passage from 1 Corinthians chapter 10 because Paul, in his letter to the Corinthians, says virtually the exact same thing to the Corinthians. And he mentions that we have a record of the lives of our patriarchs and matriarchs for precisely the same reason that Sacks mentions, that they might be examples to us. You're probably all familiar with the passage. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. I'm going to jump down to verse 6. He's talking about some of the experiences that our people have or had in the wilderness. And he goes on to say, now these things occurred as examples to keep us from setting our hearts on evil things as they did, right? And of course, this passage, what Paul is referring to, is some of the issues that we experience as we read the record of Israel's sojourn through the wilderness, which of course should have taken about 12 days, right? 11 or 12 days. But instead, it takes 40 years. And of course, it takes 40 years because that's how long it took for everyone who left Egypt to die, except for Joshua and Caleb, right? So there was a judgment upon that generation. Their children ultimately do go in and possess the land, but because of how disheartened the people become because of the report of the spies who are sent out to spy out the land, right? The people turn away from God, and God allows them to perish in the wilderness. Paul is saying that these things happened as examples for us, right? But the reason why I need to say something about this is because I've heard people talk about this, and I've heard it expressed in the sense that these people who Paul is referring to, they live out their lives in such a way, and their lives are just that, are just an example for us. I hope I'm communicating this in the way I want to, but it is as if Abraham, Isaac, Jacob's sons, Devorah, right? I mean, name somebody whose life has had an impact on yours. And it is sometimes expressed, this passage from 1 Corinthians is sometimes expressed in the sense that all of these lives were essentially, it is like they performed their lives on a stage, right? And we are in the audience watching this performance, and the objective of the producer and the director of the show is to communicate a moral lesson, or to communicate an ethical principle, to communicate something, right? It strips the real lives from these people. These people lived out their lives. They, I'm sure, at the time, had no sense whatsoever that a record would be preserved of their experiences, and that record would become meaningful for us who live, you know, generations and generations later, right? But frankly, the same thing could be said for Paul's letter to the Corinthians, right? Or his letter to any of the other congregations that he writes to. His letters were so important to the communities that they were sent to and thought to have such great value for other congregations that they were preserved, right? But frankly, when you read Paul's letter to the Corinthians, you're reading somebody else's mail. It's really not addressed to you, right? It's like you just happen to see this letter open on a table in a room you walk through, and you glance down at it, and it looks as if the subject matter is very interesting, right? So you read it, but it's not addressed to you. Now, that doesn't mean we can't apply principles from the letter to our lives, right? But we have to think of the Tanakh, of the Hebrew Bible, in that same way. These are real people who experience real things, and what they struggle with can be meaningful for us, particularly when we struggle with some of the same issues, right? So, Paul makes this point twice in these two paragraphs. Right? These things happened to them as examples, and they were written down in verse 11 as warnings for us, on whom the culmination of the ages has come. Right? So, we can trust that God is faithful because He was faithful to them. He will not let us be tempted beyond what we are capable of enduring because He did not let them be tempted beyond what they were capable of enduring. And it it makes their experiences meaningful for us if we appreciate the fact that they were every bit as real as our ours. At any rate, Sachs goes on to say, and Jacob was left alone. The wrestling match with the stranger takes place after the most elaborately conceived and executed preparations for any event in the book of Genesis. Jacob had prepared himself for three things: diplomacy, war, and prayer. He sent huge gifts of cattle to appease Esau's anger. He divided his camp in two so that even if one were destroyed, the other might survive. And of course, he prayed to God. Look at this next sentence. It's bolded and highlighted in red for a reason. He covered every eventuality, adopted every strategy, anticipated every outcome. Notice, except for the one that actually happened. Right? I mean, Jacob did his best to think of everything. And frankly, that is the way it is for us sometimes too. And the fact of the matter is that you can think through every possible scenario that, of course, you are capable of imagining and attempt to find a solution for the way any eventuality might be dealt with, right? But of course, like for Jacob, the one eventuality that he didn't prepare for was the one he couldn't conceive of, right? And of course, what is true for Jacob is true, or can be true, for us too. In Jacob's case, it was the appearance of an unnamed adversary who fought with him. And the reason why this is so important to me is because it is possible in life to do everything right, to prepare properly, to make whatever arrangements are necessary in order to accomplish whatever it is that you want to accomplish. It's possible to do everything right and still lose, still not succeed, still have things work out differently than you intended, right? You can think of it in terms of a sporting event or an individual sporting event, right, where you train hard. You know, if you're running a race, you get a good jump on the gun, you're limber, you're fit, everything's perfect, right? It's just that somebody else finishes before you, right? You didn't make any mistakes. You didn't neglect your training. You didn't not do anything properly. But sometimes we win and sometimes we don't. Which is what Sachs goes on to say in the next paragraph. Crises happen. And there is no way we can make ourselves immune to them. That is the human condition, and we cannot escape it. Something that Skip Moen and I often talk about, particularly when we teach together, is the illusion of control. Right? I mean, we all like to think that we have some control over those things that happen to us. But the fact of the matter is that that is a particularly important Western illusion, but it is an illusion, right? The fact of the matter is that the human condition is to experience the unknown, regardless of how prepared you are. We live toward an unknown, unknowable future. Even the answer God gives Moses when Moses asks him his name, I will be what I will be, tells us this. God is saying, you will not know what, where, or how I will be until the moment comes. Faith is not certainty. It is the courage to live with uncertainty. Indeed, that is why we need faith, because life is so uncertain. Even in the 21st century, when we know so much about the universe, cosmology, the human genome, and the workings of the human brain, there is one thing we do not know and never will know: what tomorrow will bring. Right? And of course, this idea is expressed by James in his letter, chapter 4. Now listen, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to this or that city, spend a year there, carry on business, and make money. Why? You do not even know what will happen tomorrow. Right? He says the exact same thing that Sack says. Why? Because this idea that faith is not certainty, it is the courage to live with uncertainty, it's because it's a Jewish value. It was a Jewish value in the first century. It's a Jewish value today. You see it in the writings of James, and you see it in the writings of a Rabbi Sacks, and frankly, many other rabbis too. Because it is a concept or an idea that simply reflects Jewish thought. Right? The point is, it's one thing to plan. There's nothing wrong with saying, today or tomorrow we will go to this or that city, and we're going to plan to spend a year there. There's nothing wrong with doing that, right? But of course, there is something wrong with imagining that you actually have the ability to pull it off, regardless of anything else that might happen, right? That's the problem. In other words, it isn't inappropriate to have goals or to have objectives or to plan things or to plan a vacation, right? But, of course, or to plan a career move or whatever it might be. But the fact of the matter is that it's important to keep those goals and objectives in perspective, right? And the perspective, of course, is that God is the one who will ultimately decide how our lives play out. And it's important for us to be flexible when we need to be. Otherwise, the alternative is to be so disappointed and so despondent when things don't go your way that you're literally crippled emotionally, and you can be incapacitated, right, in a situation like that, and spend a long time coming back up to the surface to realize what you should have known all along. Nevertheless, not my will, but your will be done. Right? Something we talked about last week. Something else that's important along these lines is what Yeshua says in the Gospel of Matthew. You know, he talks about this same idea about planning and some of the anxiety that produces planning, right? Because we have needs. Right, we have mortgages, we need to eat, we need to be clothed, so we have to plan for whatever expenses are associated with these things, right? But Yeshua says, he tells us to not be anxious about our needs, right? And he gives a beautiful illustration. He says, look at the flowers in the field and how they grow. Notice he says they don't labor or spin. in this passage from Matthew 6:28. Yet I tell you that not even Solomon in all his splendor was dressed like one of these. If that is how God clothes the grass of the field, which is here today, and tomorrow is thrown into the fire, will he not much more clothe you? You of little faith, right? So don't worry. And of course, telling us not to worry is like, you know, you have to come to terms with this idea of not worrying and not be anxious, because I would guess that we all are when situations warrant it, or it feels to us like we have plenty to be anxious or concerned about. But what's important here has to do with the fact that Yeshua says, don't worry about tomorrow. Tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day, this is going to sound a little difficult, but I've come to love this next sentence. Each day has enough trouble of its own, right? In other words, it's like there are enough things to deal with today that require our attention, and if we have to worry about tomorrow too, we're going to be overwhelmed. That's the idea, right? And I would guess you've experienced that too. And then something else that's important too. See, the only reason this is so important is because in Western thought, the future has already happened, right? Greeks looked at time in such a way that there is a past, a present, and a future, right? I know many, many people who think of the future as history written in advance, right? So they look at Bible prophecies, for example, that speak of something that God will do and assume that it is going to resolve or work itself out in exactly that way. And it's just a matter of getting to that moment when what the prophecy describes comes to pass, right? And of course, there are prophecies that speak of future events. But the prophecies that are judgmental, the prophecies that speak of punishment and judgment, those prophecies, like the prophecy over the city of Nineveh, was a warning, right? And it wasn't fulfilled literally. Jonah's prophecy regarding the destruction of Nineveh was not fulfilled the way Jonah said it would be. We still consider him a prophet of God, even though his prophecy did not come to pass, because the people of Nineveh repented. And so the warning or the judgment or the punishment was diverted. Okay? The point is that in Jewish thought, tomorrow hasn't occurred yet. It hasn't happened. Right? That's why Yeshua can say in Matthew 24, about that day or hour no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, right? Nor the Son, he says. And of course, he's referring to himself in a body of flesh and blood, because his knowledge is limited by his finite existence, his finite experience, right? Only God knows when the Messiah will be coming back to establish his kingdom. And the fact of the matter is that Yeshua says in this passage a few times that no one knows, which has always caused me to wonder why there are so many people who predict the Messiah's return and even speak about it coming or taking place at a particular time, a particular year, a particular month of the year, a particular day of the year. I mean, Yeshua himself did not know when he was coming back. How is it possible for anybody to imagine that they can acquire that knowledge that even Yeshua didn't have? I mean, it's mind-boggling to me. And what's even more mind-boggling to me is that anyone listens to it. And anyone acts on the basis of it, given what Yeshua says about it. He says, the Son of Man will come at a time and an hour when you do not expect. Okay? At any rate, Sachs goes on and says, and a man wrestled with him. We do not know who this stranger was. A man, an angel, or God himself. And of course, in the rabbinic material, there are opinions which embrace each of these, that the stranger was a man, the stranger was an angel, and the stranger was God himself. Of course, he can't be all three at the same time. What we surely do know is that the wrestling match was an externalization of Jacob's inner conflict, the result of his fear and distress. However we construe the passage, Jacob was wrestling with himself. And that is where the real battle takes place. If we can win the struggle in here, we can win it out there. And if we cannot win the struggle with ourselves, we will eventually lose our struggle with the world. The late Viktor Frankl, a psychotherapist, was a prisoner in Auschwitz. And it was there that he discovered his vocation. He saw how difficult it was to sustain the will to live. And those who lost it died. He took it as his mission to give people back the will to live. He would talk to them to discover whether they had an unfulfilled dream or a task to complete. Once he found it, he was able to give them a reason to survive. Something was calling to them from the future, and this was sometimes enough to give them the inner strength to keep going. After the war, he founded a new school of psychotherapy. He called it logotherapy, interestingly enough, based upon what he called man's search for meaning, the power of which he had seen in the camp. Crisis can challenge us at the deepest level of the self, threatening our self-confidence and self-respect. This is where we need to concentrate our effort and focus our energies. We are here because someone, the One, wanted us to be. We mentioned this last week too. He loves us, understands us, forgives us when we acknowledge our mistakes, and believes in us more than we believe in ourselves. That is where true self-confidence is born, the faith that lights the way in the heart of darkness. The Lord is with me. I will not be afraid. What can man do to me? From Psalm 118. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? Right? And of course, these ideas are repeated in the apostolic literature too. In the book of Hebrews, the author mentions, the Lord is my helper, I will not be afraid. What can mere mortals do to me? It's interesting because the author of the book of Hebrews makes the same observation, makes the same point as Rabbi Sachs makes, and uses the same passage from the book of Psalms to justify it. Right? In Hebrews chapter 13. Of course, this is expressed in Isaiah 8. This is what the Lord says to me with his strong hand upon me, warning me not to follow the way of the people. Do not call conspiracy everything this people calls a conspiracy. Right? Do not fear what they fear and do not dread it. Right? It's remarkable to me how willing people are to believe. Now, that doesn't mean that no conspiracies exist, right? But frankly, these days there's conspiracies about virtually everything, right? Even those things which seem pretty straightforward to the rest of us. And it's remarkable how many people adhere to these conspiracies, but what they are really adhering to is their fear of the future, right? And of course, this is something that in the book of Isaiah, we're encouraged not to do, not to be afraid of the future, because the Lord Almighty is the one we have to come to trust and to rely on for what our futures hold. And of course, Paul says this in Romans chapter 8. He says, we know that God works all things for good to those who love him, right? And if God is for us, who can be against us? What can compromise God's connection to us? What can compromise God's love for us? What can compromise God's compassion for us? Nothing. Right? Nothing. It doesn't always feel that way, but it's important to appreciate it. Moving on, Rashi's grandson, Rashbam, gives an extraordinary interpretation of Jacob's wrestling match. Fearing the confrontation with Esau, Jacob went to run away, and God sent an angel to wrestle with him to stop him from doing so. On this reading, God was teaching Jacob how to wrestle with his fears and defeat them. Who is strong? Asks Ben Zoma, one of the sages. Not one who can defeat his enemies, but one who can master his own impulses. Ben Zoma's proof text was a verse from Proverbs. He who is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he who rules over his spirit than he who conquers a city. Right? So it's interesting because Ben Zoma understands the struggle we have with our own nature in a way similar to some of the things that Rabbi Sacks said last week regarding prayer, right? That prayer is really about changing us. Prayer is coming to terms with who we are and what we want, what our desires are, what our connection to God looks like. What actually happened the next day when Jacob finally came face to face with Esau? Instead of attacking him, Esau ran to meet him and embraced him. There was no anger, no violence, no lingering trace of resentment. Notice this next sentence highlighted in red. Everything Jacob feared failed to happen. Which, by the way, doesn't mean that it sometimes doesn't happen, right? I mean, sometimes those things we fear do happen, right? Because in some cases the fears are rational. But there are also occasions when in our life, like in Jacob's life, something that we are afraid of happening, it doesn't, right? So, how do we learn to distinguish between the one and the other and deal with it? Was this mere coincidence, happenstance, were Jacob's fears simply misplaced? I believe the Torah is teaching a deeper truth, that once Jacob had resolved the deeper conflict within himself, he had removed the source of tension between himself and Esau. Even animals sense fear. Predators chase those who run away. The way of safety is to stay calm and still. An inner sense of self-confidence and trust does not mean that one will never have to fight battles. Economics and politics are intrinsically conflictual. Much of life is a zero-sum competition for scarce goods in which some win, some lose. You've probably heard this expression, a zero-sum game, right? A zero-sum game is like that which takes place when someone wins a contest and by definition the other person loses, right? And whether it's an individual sport or a team sport, or frankly, even if it involves shopping at a big store, right? They have a limited number of products available on the store. If you want to go to the store and pick up a particular product, right? If they have 30 of them, and you are the 31st purchaser, you're not going to get one. Right? Not from that store. So if you look at the bottom in the note, in game theory and economic theory, a zero-sum game is a mathematical representation of a situation in which each participant's gain or loss of utility is exactly balanced by the losses or gains of the utility of the other participants, right? And by the way, we often operate as if life is a zero-sum game, that for everyone who wins, there is someone else who loses, right? But if you go on and read, it goes on to say, but spiritual goods, love, trust, friendship, the pursuit of knowledge, are not zero sum. The more we share, the more we have. That I win does not mean that you lose, and vice versa, right? And of course we see this in relationships all the time. Well, take the children of Jacob, for example. Because Jacob favored Joseph, they were jealous of Joseph. Joseph's brothers were jealous of him. They didn't recognize that Jacob loved all of his sons, right? But he felt that Joseph was the best one qualified to take over the family business in his absence, right? Because Jacob gave Joseph a coat of many colors, indicating his preference for Joseph, it didn't mean that the other brothers weren't loved, weren't appreciated, right? It's something that we probably all struggle with on some level, but it's like having children, right? When your first child is born, it is hard to imagine how great your love for that child is, right? But when your second child is born, you love that child in the exact same way, right? Your love for your first child doesn't diminish with the birth of your second child. Somehow, there is enough love for both, right? That's the way it works. My self-respect never needs to be purchased at the expense of yours. I can respect you without denigrating myself. I can make space for you without denying myself. So our deepest psychological and spiritual goods need never to be bought at the cost of others. That knowledge alone that Jacob and Esau can each have their own blessings without envying one another is enough to remove many, even most, of the conflicts by which people cause one another pain. By the way, Yeshua talked about this principle too in Matthew chapter 13. When the disciples ask Yeshua, "Why do you speak in parables?" he replies, "Because the knowledge of the secrets of the kingdom of heaven have been given to you, but not to others who don't have a heart for them." Right? And then he says, "Whoever has will be given more, and they will have an abundance. Whoever does not have, even what they have, will be taken from them." Right? So it's interesting because it's repeated in a passage in Luke chapter 8. And of course, it's also mentioned in Pirkei Avot, chapter 1, paragraph 13. Right? In Pirkei Avot, Hillel used to say, "He who seeks renown loses his reputation. He who does not increase his Torah learning decreases it." Right? Which is another way of saying what Yeshua said. He who has will be given more. Right? So if you look at the paragraph of explanation, one either ascends or descends in Torah learning, but it applies to other areas of life too. If one does not continually increase in knowledge, he will inevitably forget that which he previously learned. Included in this directive is the duty to master new areas of Torah. Life is made for growth. So if you're not growing, you're dying. Right? That's the idea. At any rate, let's move on and finish this up. The sun rose upon him as he passed Penuel, limping because of his hip. Jacob limped after the fight. Crisis is real. The suffering to which it gives rise can cut deep. Even when you survive, you limp. Long afterwards, perhaps for a lifetime, you bear the scars. But they are honorable scars. They tell you that you fought and won, and greater is one who fought and won than one who, fearing confrontation, takes the path of least resistance and submits. I will not let you go until you bless me. These words of Jacob to the angel lie at the very core of surviving crisis. Each of us knows from personal experience that events that seemed disappointing, painful, even humiliating at the time, can be the most important in our lives. Through them we learned how to try harder next time, or they taught us a truth about ourselves, or they shifted our life into a new and more fruitful direction. We learn not from our successes, but from our failures. We mature and grow strong and become more understanding and forgiving through the mistakes we make. A protected life is a fragile and superficial life. Strength comes from knowing the worst and refusing to give in. Jacob, Israel, has bequeathed us many gifts, but few more valuable than the obstinacy and the resilience that can face hard times and say of them, "I will not let you go until you bless me. I will not give up or move on until I have extracted something positive from this pain and turned it into blessing." That is how the story of Jacob's struggle has helped me. And it serves to emphasize how important it is to not lose sight of the biblical text by burying it under levels of midrashic reinterpretation, which, by the way, doesn't invalidate the midrash, right? We need to recognize the midrash for what it is. Stories that are intended to teach a lesson, right? The midrash and the text itself are two very different things. At any rate, What Genesis tells us is that the heroes of our faith did not live charmed lives. They suffered exile, new danger, had their hopes disappointed, and their expectations delayed. They fought, they struggled, but they neither gave in nor gave up. They were not serene. Sometimes they laughed in disbelief. There were times when they feared, trembled, wept, and even gave way to anger. For they were human beings, not angels. They were people with whom we can identify, not saints to be worshipped. Jacob taught us that we cannot preempt crisis, nor should we minimize it, but we can survive it, thus becoming worthy of bearing the name of one who struggled with God and men and prevailed. Okay? If you look at the next section, which we don't really have the time to explore in much detail, I want you to notice that the man that wrestled with Jacob was obviously not a man. When the man saw that he could not overpower Jacob, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip, right? And the hip was wrenched from its place, right? No men have the capacity to do to Jacob what this man that Jacob wrestled with did. But what's even more interesting is that this man renames Jacob after he tells him he has to go. And Jacob says, no, I won't let you go until you bless me, right? Jacob is wrestling with a hip wrenched out of its socket, and he is still clinging to this stranger with such tenacity that the stranger renames him. He will no longer be called Jacob, heel catcher, right? Now you will be called Israel, he who struggles with God and men and prevails. And of course, the reason why this is important, in my opinion, is because it helps us to identify who this angel or man or stranger is. In my opinion, it's the angel of the Lord. Part of the reason why is because Jacob says, I saw God face to face. Right? That's what the name Penuel means. Jacob saw God's face. He doesn't say he saw an angel's face. He says he saw God's face. So somehow Jacob had the sense that he was wrestling with God, which means that in several of the Torah portions we have read so far, there has been an encounter with the angel of the Lord. And those who have the encounter with the angel of the Lord recognize that they are having an encounter with God Himself, right? And that's the way they describe it. And finally, you, of course, are familiar with the many passages in the apostolic literature that speaks about the fact that in the Messiah we are a new creation, right? And I would guess that it did not take you long to realize that the new creation was very, very much like the old one, right? I mean, the fact of the matter is that if you're in the Messiah, you're a new creation. Paul says in Romans that our old nature, our old self, was crucified with the Messiah, right? So, if that's the case, why do we sin? Why do we struggle with crises? Why do we struggle with faith? Why do we struggle with anxiety? Why do we struggle with issues like this? Why can't we overcome all the time? Right? But of course, as I mentioned, you don't have to be a believer for long before you realize that whatever change is taking place, and even though Paul speaks about it as an instantaneous event, it is only instantaneous outside of time. Right? In the world in which we live, we go through a process of becoming like the Messiah, of reflecting the values of our new nature, right? Like Jacob, even after he wrestles with God himself, he limps for the rest of his life on earth, right? In other words, even when remarkable things happen to us, and even when those remarkable things facilitate great changes, a change in the way we understand something, a change in the way we perceive something, a change in the way we, understand our relationship with God, whatever it might be, the text, the Bible, whatever it might be, the fact of the matter is that it doesn't take long for the old me to catch up with the new me, and I find the new me has to drag the old me along with him, right, throughout the course of this life. Right? You understand what I mean? The fact is that we all want to be different. Who doesn't want to be different? I mean, who wants to struggle with the same issues more than once? Right? But the fact is that we sometimes do. Right? And I think, without trivializing the issues that we struggle with, I think it would probably be nice if we could all be a little easier on ourselves and realize that our relationship with God and with others involves a process, right? So if we think more about the journey and less about the destination, right, maybe it would be easier for us to come to terms with what is actually going on in our lives. You know, something that makes it possible to deal, I don't want to say more easily with crisis, because crisis by definition is not something which it is easy to deal with, right? But you understand what I mean, right? The fact is that a crisis can destroy us or enrich us. As difficult as that second statement is to make, sometimes we're better off for the things we go through, right? Regardless of how hard they are. Okay, I'm going to stop here. Comments, observations?
All of the parshas mean something to me, but this one is personal in so many ways, because I feel like in so many ways I can connect with Jacob on an emotional level. Spending so many of his years trying to emulate his brother.
Yes.
Trying to be his brother, and oftentimes dressing the part and passing himself off as his brother. And I think what I've come to understand is that part of our growth and our maturity has to do with accepting who we are and accepting who we are not. I need to accept who I am and who I am becoming, and that's balanced by accepting who I'm not and I never will be. Recently, Melody and I watched a documentary on PBS of the life of Itzhak Perlman, a well-known violinist who's still living today, and he spoke a little bit about this. And he said something that was striking for me. He said, judge me for who I am, not for who I'm not. And here is a man who has spent his entire life with polio and is a violinist and a prodigy in many ways as being a violinist. But he struggled most of his childhood and his young adult life because people could not see past his polio. People could not see past what he could not do. And it was a part of his challenge was people recognizing him for what he could do and for who he was. And I think what we see in the Jacob story and in this Parsha is that before anyone else can accept me for who I am, I have to accept myself for who I am. And I think that that was a lifelong journey for Jacob, and I connect with that on an emotional level. That, in many ways, is my story. And I thank you for this study today. It's very rich for me.
Thank you. It's rich for me, too, for many of the same reasons. But that comment that Itzhak Perlman made, people judged him for what he was, for what he could not be, as opposed for what he could be or could do. I think that we sometimes limit ourselves by doing that to ourselves. We sometimes look at our lives and see the things we can't do rather than the things we can. Right? So I think that that is a criticism that we often level at ourselves too, or can, and it's difficult to overcome, frankly. You know, obviously today was about, you know, coming to terms with things in our own lives that we need to deal with, right? So, which is often the case. So, any other comments, observations? I feel like an auctioneer a little bit, going once, going twice. Okay, well, if there are no other comments or observations, then I guess we'll call it an afternoon. And so let me just thank you again for participating together today. It's always a blessing to see you. So Shabbat Shalom. May the Lord bless you with whatever Shabbat is left for you, or Shavua Tov. Have a good, a wonderful week. So, Lord willing, I will see you on Thursday evening or next Shabbat, whichever one you can join us for. So, may the Lord bless you and be with you and keep you. And it's good to see everyone. And I'll look forward to seeing you next time. God bless you.
Thank you, Rabbi.
My pleasure.
God bless you and thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
God bless you guys.